Mark Brewer as former chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. Jeff Timmer as former executive director of the Michigan Republicans. And this is a Republic, if you can keep it, with Mark Brewer and Jeff Timmer.
Welcome back to A Republic, if you can keep it. Later in the podcast, we'll be joined by journalist Ron Fournier to explore the constantly shifting currents in our divided nation and the wishful calls for some bipartisan cooperation.
Let's begin, though, with a quick look around Michigan and what's going on in the political landscape.
Jeff, I got to tell you that I am fascinated by this ongoing effort to have audits done, so-called audits, done of elections at the county level, as well as statewide, mimicking what's going on in Arizona. We saw over this past several days that there's now an affidavit being circulated that's addressed to Senate Majority Leader Shirky, calling on the state legislature to do what the Arizona legislature did and basically subpoena the ballots in Michigan and conduct their own audit, presumably by a private organization, but under the auspices of the legislature. We're seeing this going on in Arizona. Obviously, there have been developments in Georgia the same way. And it just seems like folks are just not giving up on, what we've come to call the big lie that somehow last year's election was stolen.
Yeah, and I think one of the dangers of this is somehow giving any shred of legitimacy to these efforts. And just by the mere fact that we call them an audit, because that's just, that almost gives them some semblance of legitimacy that they really lack, because they're not. I mean, what these are is a deliberate attempt to kind of pull the wool over to further spread propaganda. Even the big lie, I mean, that kind of sounds, a little more, sounds like a movie. You know, it doesn't sound like a threat to the American way of life. It's every bit as pernicious and dangerous as the fascism or communism was to the idea of America. The fact that we're just going to lie about who wins elections, we're going to convince enough people that they actually, the election was stolen from them, that there are interlopers in charge, and we need to remove them, not just by through the Democratic means at the next ballot box. A guy we really don't like won the election, so we need to beat them 4 years from now. We need to remove them. We need to prevent them from taking office. We need to look at ways to remove them from office. That's never been part of the American political landscape before, is in between elections. Oh, we can gather a bunch of citizens together and get our pitchforks and torches and storm the White House and put somebody else in charge.
There's a lot of danger here. I mean, what we're seeing is at this rally last weekend in Antrim County, they were attacking Ron Weiser. They were attacking Michon Maddock. They were attacking, their Republican legislators because they are not towing the line into supporting this audit. And so even the revolutionaries, the Michon Maddocks and the others of the world, are getting called out now for not being good enough on this issue. And again, I think what we're going to see out of Arizona, and if this ever comes to pass in Michigan, they're going to distort what they find. And it's going to turn into another justification for the fact that the election was fraudulent and people need to be removed from office. Like, Trump, again, what was it recently said? Oh, I'm going to be reinstated by August. And that just fueled these fantasies that his people have that somehow, some way, these audits or something is going to create some kind of miracle and put him back in office. The world just doesn't operate that way.
And let's look at that rally that was held in Antrim County this weekend. It was held on actual Nazi territory. the Frisky farm, the original Frisky, was a card carrying member of the Nazi Party and German officer. Came over to the U.S. after World War II, ended up getting elected to the Michigan legislature, where he was an unabashed white nationalist back in the 60s and 70s. It seems more than symbolic that this extreme wing of the Republican Party, I call them extreme from my perspective, they seem to be a lot more mainstream these days, that they're willing to go to those lengths, that they wouldn't look at symbolism like that and say, we need to stay away from that kind of being able to be compared to an unabashed Nazi. No, they embrace it. And we need to just say that as fact, because it is. These people embrace white nationalism. They embrace dangerous neo-Nazi theology or philosophy. And it is, it's, that's a serious threat that should concern every American.
Right. I mean, look at this rally that you talked about. We had a sitting state representative, Republican from Gaylord there. Candidates for office showed up. And then this week, when the Republican Party, Jason Rowe, the executive director, was asked about these efforts to get a state audit, said, well, you know, they're entitled to do it. Not a denunciation, not a criticism, not like that's not our party, but basically saying, because, again, I don't think the establishment of the Republican Party now wants to take these folks on. Saying basically, well, you know, to each their own, and they're entitled to do this. And so that does nothing but encourage them. That does nothing but encourage them. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see as these alleged affidavits start to show up in legislative offices in the Capitol, what the Speaker and the Majority Leader in the Senate do about it, lest these people turn on them.
I'll just question, given his actions over the last 6 months, I wouldn't say that the Senate Majority Leader is necessarily opposed to any of this from what I've seen over these last months. It's not going to surprise me if he ends up going along with these people, not because he feels like he has no choice, but because he thinks like they do.
Well, you know, given his track record of posing for photographs with people who ultimately ended up under indictment for trying to kidnap and kill the governor, admitting that he gave messaging advice to the militia, you know, and met with them on that very threatening day at the state capitol a year ago. I agree with you. It would not surprise me at all to see Shirky find some way to go along with this idea that we need to have some, quote, forensic audit, even though that is not what it is at all. I don't think people even know what that means, but it sounds good. And it's a bit of propaganda that they can use.
Jeff and Mark will be back after these messages.
Epic MRA is pleased to be a sponsor of this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with decades of experience measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, federal, state, and local issues. Our clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, and local governments across the state. When it comes to measuring voter opinions, Epic MRA has been known as the go-to Michigan pollster for over 25 years. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
The Michigan Polycast. It's been called one of Michigan's top political podcasts by Hourly Detroit.
Each week, longtime political junkies Christine Barry and Walt Sorg offer news and views on Michigan politics and policy, as well as national issues impacting our pleasant peninsulas. And they are joined by some of the state's biggest names from government, politics, academia, and nonprofit groups, with an in-depth look at those issues.
Subscribe now to the Michigan Polycast, online at www.michiganpolycast.com.
Ron Fournier is the former Washington, D.C. bureau chief for the Associated Press, and also was publisher and editor of Crane's Detroit Business. He now serves as president at Truscott Rossman, one of the state's most respected public relations firm. A Detroit native, Ron began his family and career in Arkansas, covering then-Governor Bill Clinton before moving to Washington in 1993, where he covered the White House and national politics for the Associated Press during the administrations of Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama.
Fournier is also a former columnist for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief for the National Journal, and was a 2005 fellow at the Harvard Institute of Politics, where he co-wrote the New York Times bestseller, Appleby's America. For several years, he served on the Harvard IOP's Board of Advisors. Before returning to Detroit in the fall of 2016, Ron published a parenting memoir, Love That Boy, What Two Presidents, Eight Road Trips, and My Son Taught Me About a Parent's Expectations. It debuted number 10 on Amazon and was a New York Times bestseller.
Ron holds the Society of Professional Journalists Sigma Delta Chi Award for coverage of the 2000 presidential election, and he is a four-time winner of the prestigious White House Correspondents Association Merriman Smith Memorial Award. Welcome, Ron Fournier, to Republic, if you can't keep it.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, Ron, you know, you certainly have a long career observing politics, being involved in the political arena in Washington and in Michigan as a reporter and as leading an agency that's involved in the political and policy arena. Your perspective is certainly very welcome to our listeners, hearing about perspective of both Washington and Michigan politics. And so we're very glad to have you today.
I'm honored to be with you. I've been pretty lucky. I've had an old enough man to have had a pretty good career.
You know, one thing I keep being reminded of is, you know, what seemed controversial in politics to us, say, maybe a decade ago, now seems kind of quaint. When you look at what we used to consider polarized politics, be it in Lansing at the Capitol or in Washington, I think we'd all welcome those days back when we could have rational disagreements on, say, marginal tax rates or things like that, as opposed to fundamental issues like, should we have democratic elections any longer? So we find ourselves at a, kind of standing at a precipice and staring into some pretty, a dark future, depending on which way the winds are blowing here.
Now, I was just talking about this with an old friend of mine. I remember the first scandal I covered in Washington. I just moved from Arkansas to the White House, and there was this huge story going on about the travel office. A bunch of folks in the White House travel office have been fired. And we wrote for weeks about how horrible it was that George Stephanopoulos, who is the communications director, and somebody else on his staff had the temerity to have a meeting with somebody at the Justice Department to talk about the wording in the press release about the travel office firings. And that was crossing a line that nobody had seen since Nixon was run out of the White House. How can the White House be talking to the Justice Department about something like this? And we were all outraged, and, it was a huge scandal. And, now we have a president, the former president, Trump, who, outwardly said the Justice Department worked for him, and he demanded that the Attorney General do his bidding and that the Justice Department was his private law firm. So we've come a long way in a lifetime, and you're right, it's pretty sad.
Do you think there's any chance that we can kind of move back toward that, or has Trump kind of permanently lowered the bar in so many areas so far that there's no hope of getting back to that kind of culture?
I'm a pretty pessimistic guy. I see very little hope, but I don't pin it on Trump. Trump is a symptom of the problem, a horrible, toxic, traitorous, corrupt, vile, immoral symptom of the problem. The real problem is us, a nation of people who've decided to use the technologies that give us a lot of power. Power that used to be only in the hands of a few gatekeepers. I used to actually be one of those. We've used the technology and our mobility and our wealth to separate ourselves from one another, to walk around in intellectual bubbles, to never have to confront an opinion that's different than ours, to never have to confront a fact that counters our opinions. And yes, it's far worse on the right in politics than it is on the left. But it's awfully bad on the left, and it's not just in politics now, where we have this phenomena where Americans are willing to be lied to and to lie to one another, and are becoming absolutists. We just do not want to support anybody in office who compromises. We don't want to compromise ourselves. And we don't want our politicians to compromise. If we can't have everything 100% our way, then to hell with the other side. So this is a we the people problem. We are incenting our politicians not to compromise. We elected Donald Trump once. Now, not all of us, but this country did. And we support throughout politics, and not just the national level now, people who are incented to be polarized, to fight, to not get anything done. So this is bigger than Trump, and I don't know how we how we put this toothpaste back in the tube, how we teach people not just to know the difference between truth and fiction, dangerous lies and uncomfortable truths, but how we teach them to want to actually give a shit about the truth, because right now most of us don't.
I think that's a very good point. I mean, we're the divide goes so beyond politics. It's so cultural. It's visceral. I was at a graduation open house this last weekend and talking to an acquaintance, and they were talking about how their son is preparing to move to Oregon to take a job. And somebody else piped up, Oregon, why would they want to move there? That's a Democrat state. And we just kind of looked at each other, the father and I, and went, that's a bizarre way to look at this. But it shows you this, what we're seeing, that there are people who divide themselves based on, you know, now it's just geography. If you live there, it harkens back to the divide we saw 150 years ago at the Civil War. If, you know, it's now people are seeing this as a, you live here, you're a blue person, you live there, you're a red person, completely different values, perspective, outlooks. It's very, very strange time to be living through with apparently, at least what I like to think, with my eyes open, and so many people don't seem to have them.
It's interesting because we are living in a time unlike any time since the post-Civil War period, when our media is polarized. Back in the 1850s, 1860s, up until about 1900, every newspaper, it was the only medium of the time, only mass medium of the time, was owned by one of the two parties. And Abe Lincoln, when he ran for the Senate, he knew he had to buy a German newspaper. If he wanted the German votes, he had to buy himself a newspaper. So it was a very intellectually polarized time then. People walked around and you bought the Republican newspaper or the Whig newspaper, the Democratic newspaper. We're now in a time like that, but it's so much more pernicious, because back then you had to buy a newspaper. And then you went back to your family, and maybe one of you could read it, and you read it to the rest of the family, and you still had to meet somebody at the market who thought differently than you, and you communicated more by word of mouth than you did through the newspaper. Now we are hyper-connected, unlike any time since the beginning of humanity, where we all have these phones that give us access to all of the world's information since the beginning of time. And now we can radically connect with one another and only connect with people who think like us. So we've been polarized before, but not, we didn't have the ability to be this hyper-polarized. To literally, you can go through life and never confront an opinion that doesn't match up against your bias. And there are people in this country, good people, who really think the election was stolen. They are convinced of it, because it's so easy now to spread and cement that lie, easier than it's ever been since caveman times. And now we can do it in a radically connected way. You can now mobilize millions of people instantly around a dangerous lie. That's something new to humanity, not just to this country. And it's scary.
You're absolutely right. But I also think it's, in some ways it's worse than that. Not only can you pick who to talk to, but others can pick who to talk to. You know, with these algorithms that operate on social media, that, you know, you are being targeted constantly through your devices by these algorithms in terms of what you see, who you communicate with, et cetera, et cetera. So it's got.
I'm going to push back on that. I'm going to push back on that. The problem isn't Facebook and Twitter and algorithms. Algorithm is a mathematical tool that a human being designs and that we let ourselves be led by. I know you. I follow the two of you. You're not led around by the nose intellectually by an algorithm. You're able to get outside of what Facebook puts in front of you. You're able to see things beyond that algorithm. Why? Because you want to. So it's not social media that's doing this. It's not Trump that's doing this. It's not the algorithm that's doing this. We are doing it. If you want to think, if you want to be an open-minded, broad-minded thinker, a critical thinker, you still can be. The problem is most of us don't want to be. So I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think we've got to stop blaming mathematical formulas, Mark Zuckerberg and Donald Trump, and start looking at each other. Start looking at ourselves. You know, are we raising our kids to want to know the truth? Not just to know the truth, but to even give a crap about it.
Well,
we're not.
I agree, but my point was that these algorithms and the targeting take advantage of the human trait you have just described.
You're exactly right about that. Yep. I'm sorry. Yes, you're exactly right. It's human beings. We are bred to be, and it's in our DNA to be lemmings and to lie to each other. And we've allowed the technology to really exploit that worst part of our human nature. I get you. You're right.
Sure. Oh, that's a gloomy take on the human race.
Well, look, we're now a bunch of tribes. You know, technology's brought us back to, you know, the most basic form of humanity. That's where we are now. We're back in our caves.
Yeah.
And we're following the strongest, what we think is the strongest man over the cliff.
My observation is Americans are not inherently a political culture. Most people across the swath of the country are very apolitical. They care more about who wins The Voice than who wins, you know, a congressional election in most cases. And the fact that I think one of the things that is perhaps pushing a lot of people away to kind of, I guess, bury their heads further in the sand is the constant 24/7 barrage of political news, or the way Trump was in our face 24/7, 365. It just wore people out. People who didn't like it to start with couldn't get away from it, and now find themselves still unable to get away. And they're doing anything to kind of tune out a lot of the, what is overtly political, rhetoric, political news. And I just think that exacerbates the divide.
No, I agree completely. We have stopped functioning as a coherent, unified country with a shared sense of facts and a shared sense of stories. You know, this nation has never been anything other than a great story, a great idea. And we now don't share that idea. There's not a common sense of purpose. And without that, I really worry about our country, even beyond the obvious things like one party now trying to delegitimize our elections in a way that, you know, we could actually have a party stealing elections, in the next cycle. That's the most obvious danger. But even beyond that, there's just not enough people who seem to care about the fact that that's happening.
So I hate to ask the big question, but what do we do to fix this? What do we do to change this? I mean, does it take, you know, some kind of outside threat? I mean, literally what happened to us in the world wars, what happened to us during the Civil War, to try to, you know, drive people back to some kind of common vision of what this country was. I mean, we had that in the Revolution, right? Allegedly, we all hated the king in England and what he was doing to us. At least that's the story. And so forth, in other wars and catastrophes. I mean, does it need to get that bad before we're finally going to start to come back together as a country with some kind of unified?
I don't know. You know, this has been something that's been happening pretty steady now for the last 20 years, and I've been waiting for those moments. So we had an attack 2020 in the 9/11 attack, which for a moment it seemed to bring some common sense and civility to politics, but it was a moment. We had a huge economic collapse. We had the election of the first African-American president. None of that seems to have shaken us from this doldrums. I think what it's going to have to take, and I don't know if we have it in us, is a new generation of leaders who are willing to risk their political careers to fundamentally change the rules of politics and community, who are willing to do things like have the modern day version of the fair trade, what was the regulations around TV and radio back in the beginning of the 20th century? The fairness doctrine. Yeah. Who are willing to tackle gerrymandering in a real way? Who are willing to have open primaries in which moderate candidates are elected instead of the most extreme candidates of both parties? Who are just willing to change the fundamentals of our politics in a way that would probably destroy their careers, but make it possible for the country to really reform itself. But it's got to be that kind of major overhaul, the kind of changes we saw at the beginning of the in the early 1900s the latter part of the Depression, the beginning of coming out of World War II.
I agree, and I hope that's coming.
Once in a century change, we're due for.
No, I'm not alone in this, that the only thing that's going to ever fix and add kind of the stability to our the equilibrium of our politics is to have a stable center right and a stable center left, and to reestablish a stable, sane democratic a center right that believes in actual democracy, that isn't illiberal, is going to take some losses by the Republicans, several cycles of losses before we could see what happened in the mid 1800s with the collapse of the Whig Party and the divide there that kind of reestablished then a center right fulcrum. I don't know that that's going to happen, but I know that's what it's going to take. Whether or not 2022 provides a lifeline to the Trump brand of Republicans, we're going to find out. And it's a frightening prospect as we look toward him running again in 2024. And look at everything that went wrong. You look at an occasion for us to pull together a national emergency, like a pandemic where 500,000 people die, in the span of a few months. That would seem to be an occasion for everybody to pull together, but it drove the divide even further. When you look at everything that went wrong from Trump's his own personal, malfeasance and abhorrent behavior, to his mishandling of the pandemic and the economic collapse and job losses that came with it. And look at how close he still came to winning, about 45,000 votes spread across a few states, and he wins a second term. It's staggering to me.
It just shows you how far away we are from solving this issue. There's that many Americans who think that the best alternative to a liberal form of government is a buffoon like Donald Trump. And liberals like us have got to look inward. And what does that say about our movement in our party, that tens of millions of people think Donald Trump is a better alternative than what we offered 4 years ago, and almost a better alternative, or 5 years ago, and almost a better alternative than what we offered a year ago? That should cause some serious misgivings in the Democratic Party, but it hasn't. It's not good enough, even for a Democrat like me, for a liberal like me, it's not good enough for Democrats to win in 2022 and 2024, although I desperately want them to, but that's not going to be enough. It's not going to be enough unless what we do with that victory is reform our politics, reform the way we communicate and build communities in this country, and be a party that cares about things beyond winning the next election and demonizing the other side. And be a party that is a big enough tent to be able to accept a guy like Joe Manchin who pisses us all off. I don't know that either party is committed to the kind of reforms that this country needs, and that's what really worries me.
Ron, if we can get into some more detail, what kind of reforms, and you kind of touched on this a little bit, what kind of reforms would you like to see? You mentioned open primaries, you're talking about ranked choice voting, obviously you touched on gerrymandering. I mean, do you have a list that you've developed of the kind of changes you think are necessary?
Well, that's two right there. If we had House districts in every state and in Congress, where the conservative liberal split was within 5 percentage points of the national election, we would have state legislators and Congresses that were filled with people who were incented to compromise, who had to find a way to work with the other side because they had to appeal to voters in the middle. That would be a huge change from what we have now, where you have most of our 90% of our districts are going to be won by Republicans or Democrats no matter what happens. So all you're worried about is not being primary. So you're incented to be extreme, to be further to the left than the other candidates or further to the right if you're running in a conservative district. And then, yes, ranked choice voting is another way to incentivize our politicians to compromise, to get things done, to be civil, because it's an election system that gives moderates a voice and doesn't just incentivize extremism. I think we do need to look at how do we maintain our First Amendment and maintain the huge positive lifestyle effects that companies like Facebook and Twitter provided, but do so in a way that doesn't reward, that doesn't weaponize lies and hate. We as a public, and it's not even just a party thing, have got to embrace these and other reforms in which we elect people to get things done, to work with the other side, to find common ground. We've got to decide as a people that that's what we want in our elected officials. Right now, we have collectively decided, this last generation, that we want absolutists. We actively vote out people who compromise and try to get the other side and who disagree at all with us on any one issue. We will get rid of them. We want somebody who's 100% our way, or if they're only 10% against us, that means they're 100% against us. We've got to stop that attitude and enact the kind of reforms that reward a different kind of behavior.
Would campaign finance reform and the role of money in our politics make your list? If so, why?
I got to be honest. I've never seen money as the problem, as much of a problem as the things that I'm talking about here. I do think that if I could wave a magic wand, there'd be no such thing as dark money. That if my senator is bought and paid for by big tobacco, I should know it. But if 51% of the people in my district under the kind of campaign reforms that I'm talking about elect somebody who's in the pocket of big tobacco, okay, then we've all made that decision openly. My problem is we don't know where the money is coming from. And so we don't know who's buying our politicians. The amount of money doesn't bother me as much as how dark it is and the kind of corruption that fosters.
So things like, much quicker and obviously broader disclosure of all the money in politics.
Look, there's no reason why. I mean, let's start using technology to make our system more efficient and more transparent. There's no reason why as soon as a check is deposited in the bank of any political committee, whether it's a candidate or a C4 or a ballot committee, that it can't instantly be disclosed. We have that technology. Our politicians in both parties just don't want it to happen.
Right.
There's no reason why we can't vote all year round and change our votes again and again and again until they're finally locked in on election day. There's no reason why we can't do that. Why can't I change my mind and vote whenever and wherever I want? The only reason I can is because both parties don't want me to do that. There's no reason why I can't vote for a third party candidate if I'm not happy with either one of these. Why can't I? Why? Because these two parties, this duopoly, won't let it happen. They've rigged the system so that we really only have a choice between two parties. We can change these rules if we really wanted to. We could have instant disclosure. We could have all year round 24/7 voting. We can have the country we want. Right now, we're happy. We really are happy with the system. Why do I say that? How do I know that? Because we're not fighting it. We, the people, want people serving us who will not compromise, who will lie to us in the service of winning the next election. Once we demand something different, we'll get it, as long as we still have a democracy. But right now, we seem to be pretty happy in our intellectual bubbles, being lied to by the party of our choice, and only caring about winning arguments and winning elections.
Ron, I mean, you've had just an amazing career in terms of, the things you've been involved in, events you've covered, administrations, national politics, international politics. Are there countries out there, I just got to ask, are there countries out there who have elements of what you're talking about that you think we should copy or adapt to fix the problems in our own politics?
Yeah, there's countries out there, and there's states in our country, and there's communities in our country that are doing things right. You know, Bill Clinton liked to say, there's not a problem in America that's not being solved somewhere in America. And I guess you could also say there's not a problem in the world that's not being solved somewhere in the world. For all of our problems, and as far as down as I am on the trajectory of our politics, ironically, since I got into it in the late 80s, there's still not a better country on earth, and there's still not a richer, more dynamic, more diverse country on earth that has the capacity to turn this around. I'm just feeling right now pretty glum about our willingness to do so. We have the ability, but I'm feeling pretty glum about our willingness to do so. But yeah, there's examples out there.
I think that's a very interesting perspective. The fact that the majority coalition that did want to remove Trump from the White House, that wanted to elect Joe Biden or simply remove Trump, however they came to be part of that coalition, I think that the 81 plus million people, a good number of them are just weary. They're weary of this. They're not necessarily engaged in. They look at the results, the election we were able to get past the Electoral College, past January 6th, and inaugurate Joe Biden is, whew, we've dodged the bullet. Now, you know, on with our lives, which is where people would like to be, but it's not. We don't have that luxury because that minority that supported Donald Trump is still very organized and very energized, and we're at risk because they're plotting and planning and working every day to maintain their grip on power, even though they represent a distinct minority voice in this country. And that's what's good. Just the apathy, just weariness that comes with is just, that's what we need to overcome, is because there's certainly the numbers, and if people can be made aware or made to believe the threat is real and urgent, we have the capacity to overcome it. It's just keeping that level of fervor at a high kind of the DEFCON 1 level, it's hard to do. The other side is definitely focused on it, and you see it every day. This is a long way of saying I agree. I'm disheartened because I know it's hard to sustain that, and that's what's needed to make sure that the illiberal side, the side that's ready to lurch toward authoritarianism, that's what it takes to beat them. And I don't know that we have the staying power, the attention span to do it.
I think, and this actually, Jeff, what you just said ties in with what we heard from Ron earlier, that our system is really set up so that a minority can consistently block what the majority wants, and if it's persistent enough and organized enough, can get its way one way or the other, through turnout, through lobbying, whatever the case may be, through organizing. And that has become a real problem. I mean, the founders talked about, we want to have decentralization, separation of powers, federalism, and so forth. But that has made us so fragmented that groups less than a majority have discovered ways that they can take advantage of that system, right? That the rest of us want to go on with our lives and we're not interested in doing politics 24/7, but others can take advantage of that And, you know, I think that reinforces the dysfunction that Ron was talking about earlier, that people will take advantage of all that. I think, you know, and this actually, Jeff, what you just said ties in with what we heard from Ron earlier, that, you know, our system is really set up so that a minority can consistently block what the majority wants. And if it's persistent enough and organized enough, can get its way one way or the other through turnout, through lobbying, whatever the case may be, through organizing. And that has become a real problem. I mean, the founders talked about, oh, we want to have decentralization, separation of powers, federalism, and so forth. But that has made us so fragmented that and groups less than a majority have discovered ways that they can take advantage of that system, right? That the rest of us want to go on with our lives and we're not interested in doing politics 24/7. But others can take advantage of that. And, you know, I think that reinforces the dysfunction that Ron was talking about earlier, that people will take advantage of all that.
I wonder if the answer lies in the Americans that we never talk about. You know, we talk all the time about voters and how the parties are going after them and using different tactics. But most, you know, we have millions and millions and millions and millions of Americans who don't vote, who are completely checked out from the political system, who are there for the taking, for either party who wanted to find a new way to appeal to them and engage them. And instead of doing that, both parties, to different degrees, and I think one is far, far worse than the other, are engaged in a zero-sum game set of politics that turns off millions of Americans who want more than a polarized, bipolar, zero-sum game, obnoxious, irrelevant political system. What would happen if one of the parties, instead of trying to keep pandering to voters who are demanding that they be absolutists and
be as liberal as possible, from my perspective, I bet you the same thing is true from Jeff and his background, found a way to bring in millions of disengaged voters, a lot of time and effort, obviously unsuccessfully.
My guess is
trying to motivate would be interested that group, in a different Ron, kind of you're talking about to get engaged. I mean, again, maybe
and
we
certainly
were,
would not
you know,
be
our focus was too narrow,
motivated
and
by
we
the politics
talking about
of
things
the right.
That appeal to them.
But might
I know
be
both
motivated by
about that, but
a more open-minded, bigger tent, either third party or a liberal party that was willing to accept views that didn't check all the traditional liberal boxes. There's a lot of voters that every cycle are on the table that we don't even talk about as political journalists or as political party leaders. What kind of country do we have if 80% of the public voted? You know, instead of 30% in some elections or 40%.
Yeah, I know for my party, from my perspective, I bet you the same thing's true from Jeff and his background, that, you know, we devoted a lot of time and effort, obviously unsuccessfully, trying to motivate that group, Ron, that you're talking about to get engaged. I mean, you know, again, maybe we were, you know, our focus was too narrow and we weren't talking about things that appeal to them. I know both political parties talk about that, but they're not successful at it.
I got to tell you, the two parties I covered were interested in motivating their base voters. They were interested in, for a while in the 80s and 90s, they were interested in motivating the between 8 and 12% of voters who swung back and forth. Right. But neither party, since I've been in the business in the late 80s, was focused on the people who don't vote. The people who are disengaged from the system, who are not practicing as Americans.
You're right.
Easier to motivate people, your base voters, because all you got to do is make them hate the other side real bad.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, we would talk about it, but in the end, our resources would go in the same places to motivate exactly the group that you just talked about, Ron. That's exactly
where the greatest return on investment would be. And you're right. There's at the end of the day,
it made business sense, but it did make civic sense. And now we're paying the price.
Well, I know that, you know, we are at the end of our time and we want to really, we've had a wonderful conversation. I wish we could find more of a silver lining in this cloud, but it speaks to the times we're in and why conversations like this are important to keep having and to keep pushing and to keep trying, because what we have is worth fighting for. It's worth saving, and it's worth investing the sweat equity into to try to make it better. And so we want to thank you for joining us, Ron Fournier. It's been wonderful to have you.
Thank you, gentlemen, for everything you do and for having me on. You take care.
It's time to call it a wrap for this week. Our great thanks to Ron Fournier. As always, we welcome your feedback. Drop us a note at comments@arepublicpodcast.com or add your comments to our Facebook page.
And if you like the podcast, tell your friends and add your rating to Apple Podcasts. If the Republic is still standing, we'll be back in a week. I'm Mark Brewer.
And I'm Jeff Timmer. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It, wherever you get your podcasts, or on our website, arepublicpodcast.com. A Republic If You Can Keep It, with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer, as a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.